From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, I'm excited to tell you that we have an interview with Vermont author Julia Alvarez, whose new book is Afterlife, a novel published by Algonquin. Julia Alvarez left the Dominican Republic for the United States in 1960 at the age of 10. She's the author of 6 novels, 3 books of nonfiction, 3 collections of poetry, and 11 books for children and young adults. She has taught and mentored writers in schools and communities across America, and until her retirement in 2016, she was a writer in residence at Middlebury College. Her work has garnered wide recognition, including a Latina Leader Award in Literature from the Congressional Hispanic Caucus Institute, the Hispanic Heritage Award in Literature, the Woman of the Year by Latina Magazine, and inclusion in the New York Public Library's program, The Hand of the Poet, original manuscripts by 100 masters, from John Donne to Julia Alvarez. In The Time of the Butterflies, with over 1 million copies in print, was selected by the National Endowment for the Arts for its National Big Read program. And in 2013, President Obama awarded Julia Alvarez the National Medal of Arts in recognition of her extraordinary storytelling. Antonia Vega, the immigrant writer at the center of Alvarez's new novel, Afterlife, has had the rug pulled out from under her. She has just retired from the college where she taught English when her beloved husband Sam suddenly dies, and then more jolts. Her big-hearted but unstable sister disappears, and Antonia returns home one evening to find a pregnant, undocumented teenager on her doorstep. Antonia has always sought direction in the literature she loves. Lines from her favorite authors play in her head like a soundtrack. But now she finds that the world demands more of her than words. Set in this political moment of tribalism and distrust, Afterlife asks, what do we owe those in crisis in our families, including, maybe especially, members of our human family? How do we live in a broken world without losing faith in one another or ourselves? And how do we stay true to those glorious souls we have lost? My interview with Julia Alvarez begins with my first question. I hope you enjoy our conversation. I love Afterlife. I really enjoyed it. It has a number of unfolding threads. And so your main character, Antonia, has lost her husband. And then a neighbor's immigrant employee asks for help bringing his girlfriend to stay. And then Antonia's erratic sister, Izzy, unexpectedly disappears. So I thought we could start out by having you talk about how the story evolved for you, but also how you kept these balls in the air as you worked, because I thought it went really well, beautifully together, and yet there are various strands unfolding.
When I look at the descriptions that the publisher put out when the book was coming out, her first adult novel in 15 years, I thought, oh my gosh, you know, it's 15 years, but I've been writing every day, you know. It's very much a practice for me, a way of life, a way of, like, breathing. So I have been writing, but I think I was, you know, I describe it as my first novel written as an elder, because one of the questions that I was asking myself was, what are the stories? I didn't want to just keep repeating what I had already learned and done, and felt like I have, you know, some mastery of, or some confidence in. I wanted to find, you know, how to pull all the many strands that have been sort of piling up into a narrative. And you know, there were so many concerns about one of them, about loss and something that happens as you get older, that, you know, more and more the people you love and knew are gone. And so how do you deal with that loss? I wanted also, you know, the kinds of challenges that come to us, not just as abstractions, the immigration issue, you know, Vermont and its dairy farms and what's going on with a small farmers feeling they, you know, they need to survive and they don't have a workforce. You know, these are all issues we hear about, but how does it impact when it comes to your door? I wanted to understand that. Of course, sisterhood has always been a big theme for me. So how do sisters operate as older women, you know, and how does family work? Your origin family, your beginning nuclear family evolves over time. So all of these little pieces, you know, were in my head. And I think part of the reason that it took me a long time is that I kind of wanted to put all of these things together into a narrative. And so, you know, you know how it's done, Sheila. You write and you rewrite and you write and you rewrite. And, you know, part of the challenge also was I always wanted to write a short, what I call lyrical novel that's sort of at the border there with poetry, you know, compact with that Japanese sensibility of taking more and more things away so that what remains is charged. Yeah. So I also had that challenge of how to put it together in a compact way. So what, you know, as Pascal said, had I had more time, I would have written a shorter letter. So it took time, yeah. But I wanted, you know, I wanted a novel that was almost as complex as my life felt with all these things coming at me.
Well, that's a good point, because I recognized Antonia in reading about her. She's a Vermont professor and writer. She's married to a physician, or was until he passed away. So I wondered how it was for you writing about a woman who, at least on the page, seems a lot like yourself.
Well, you know, I think I once was on a panel with Julia Glass, and the panel was autobiography or fiction. And we were, I guess, you know, I was there as the representative of autobiographical fiction, and she was there as like a fiction writer, you know, a total fiction writer. And she started out by saying, no, come on. All novels are emotionally autobiographical. It's just that the membrane is more clearly, it's very thin, and you can see the lineaments of that writer. And another, it's, you know, maybe it's about Napoleon, but the writer is dealing maybe with issues of their relationship with a very strong bullying father or something. You know, there's got to be some juice there. So I feel like one of the things, my life, as you heard from the beginning, and my work are very integrated. Mm-hmm. You know, for me, writing is a way of living. And so, of course, my life also gets into my writing. That said, I'm not very interested in Julia Alvarez. I mean, I'm tired of her. I want to get away from her. We read in order to become the other. And so when I create a character, it is an other. It isn't Julia Alvarez. However, I need Julia Alvarez. She moves in the world. She knows all the people. She has all the sensual apparatus. She has things she hears. I need that. I need that in the writing. And so whatever I can use to make a fiction, a narrative out of her experience and the things that are the juice, you know, the emotional gasoline in her that's going to drive my car as a writer. Sorry for the fossil fuel metaphor. I am going to use. Think of Henry James, what his advice to the young writer is, be him, I'll add, or her, on whom nothing is lost. That's the thing. You're always moving through the world as a writer, picking up things. And so, you know, I need all that Julia is able to do and you know, has access to when I'm writing, you know.
Yeah.
And sometimes I don't even know what I've made up, you know, where the fiction just took off, you know, because a character might start from someone or a person I've known, or and puzzled by or concerned by. But once, you know how that happens, once you enter narrative, it takes up on its own momentum and it has its own modus operandi. And you have to operate by that operating system, not by the tyranny of what really happened. You know, it's really hard sometimes with young writers to say, you know, you can use that material, but it has to work in the story.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. You know? Yeah. Now, one thing that Antonia is going through is the loss of her husband. And I thought you wrote just beautifully about her grief. I loved this line that occasionally she takes sips of sorrow. I thought that was so beautiful. She takes sips of sorrow. She doesn't let herself get completely engulfed by it. And then she's from time to time thinking about, you know, the afterlife and what, and one, at one point you write, what she wouldn't give for his voice coming from the afterlife, assuring her that he's okay. And isn't that lovely that she's worried that he's okay, you know, and not just completely self, concerned. And, anyway, I liked following her journey. And she watches for signs from him. And so that is this lovely underlying truth of her life, not a happy truth, but it's very beautifully rendered as all this other stuff is going on. So I wonder if you want to talk a little bit about writing her grief.
Well, you know, as I said, at this point in life, even though I haven't lost my husband.
Thank goodness.
Yes, thank goodness. You know, I've been through a lot of grieving. I come from a Latino family, and which means in our culture, not, you know, a nuclear parents and siblings, but, you know, cousins and aunts and uncles. My father was the youngest of 25. The first wife had 10. Second wife, and she died. And then the second wife had 15. So I come from a clan. You know, it's just huge. And it's always been so wonderful because there's so many options, so many stories. But what happens as you get older in life is that you don't just lose one auntie, one uncle, you know, a couple of cousins. You lose a whole phalanx of people. You lose a whole community in a family. And so the experience of death was something that I was very acquainted with, losing both my parents, losing my sister. You know, it just, I knew this landscape. I knew the world. I knew the under, what I call being in the underworld of grieving and how it works and how you try not to let it completely overpower you by just, you know, doing little bits of it. And one of the things that interested me too is, you know, I read also, I mean, it wasn't just Julia Alvarez as her own experience that I used, but I read a lot of memoirs and novels, more and more because of my demographic. I'm interested in novels with older main characters, and especially older women, and memoirs too. And I remember reading Joanna Lacey, who translates Rilke, beautiful translator, but talking about grieving and talking about, you know, her own grieving for her when she lost her husband. That a love story doesn't, there can be a love story with a deceased love, a great love, that it continues, that it's not the same kind of love, obviously, and it's not maybe physical, corporal, but that there is a love story. Sam continues in her life, in her head. And that's what I meant to by the title Afterlife, is that not, you know, some heaven or some, you know, religious understanding of it, but that when we lose the people that we loved, we lose all of them if we let what we loved in them die too. It's almost like we have to carry those, you know, those approaches and values, and in some ways, we have to carry that forward so that that doesn't die. So I was really interested in that idea of how the people, you know, that we lost and we love how we have to, in some ways, give them body.
Yeah. I was going to ask you about that because I feel like Sam is very present in this book. And I wanted to know, you know, if you wanted to talk a little bit about building the character of a person who has passed away, but is still very, very much present in the story. He plays good cop to her bad cop, she says. And his personality, the person he was, is actually really a part of who she is now and seems to be changing her even still. And I thought that was really interesting, the way that you let him be a character in the story, even though it's in a very different way.
Well, aren't books the way we give afterlives? I mean, these characters we create out of words and narratives and memories. What we read, you know, this is how we're giving a body, a being to somebody totally fictionalized. You know, it could be a character, a Hamlet, you know, they never existed, but you're creating it with all the details that you're given. So you know, in writing about Sam through her memories and her her ways of interacting with him and her speaking with him, we get a real sense of who he was in his own right. So I think that is why I think the people we lose don't die, mm-hmm. Because while we are still remembering them, they're still alive.
Right.
In a certain kind of way. What is the Mexican Day of the Dead that a person dies three times when they physically die, you know, their body? The second death occurs when you put them in the ground, you know, when you bury them. And the third death is when no one remembers their name or their story. And that's the last death. So I think while we who love someone, remember them and tell the stories, they're still alive in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I love memorial services where it's, you know, one person after another gets up and tells a story about that person. And you feel like, oh my God, in some ways, when I've walked out of a memorial service like that, I think I know this person better now than I ever knew them.
Yeah.
Because I just... You know, I just knew my story and maybe a couple of stories.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, who knew, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Now, Sam has another role, I think, in the book, which I thought was really interesting and I wanted to talk about with you, which is just the nature of his personality works almost as a foil to Antonia's own sort of the way she wrestles with being a good person and being a contented person. And kind of coming up against her own flaws, she sees him as having been in some ways better than she is. And I thought that worked really well because it created this much rounder, more honest portrayal of her because she was able to think about what would Sam say in this situation. And she kind of argues with him a little bit in her head. And that was really cool, I thought.
Well, you know, it's funny that you say that because one of the things that I wanted was a main character that was at least, I didn't want to airbrush her. You know, I wanted to give her the respect of allowing her to be fully complicated, you know. And so some of the things that I was working with is, you know, some of the assumptions that we have about ethnicity,
mm-hmm.
you know, in this couple, everyone assumes that because she's Latina, she's the real activist, you know, and Sam getting involved in all kinds of causes and having this, you know, liberal approach and, you know, argumentative side of him, at dinner parties, arguing for very liberal leftist causes. They think, oh, she's radicalized him. And in fact, he's the one that is much more of an activist, and she calls herself a reluctant activist. She's dragged into it, you know, sort of kicking and resisting. And so I wanted to create diversity, not just in the characters in terms of their ethnicity or their background or their, traditions, but ethnicity within a within an ethnicity. You know, that not, you know, that these assumptions we make about each other are ways in which we don't see each other. And it goes, she does it to other people. She calls it her othering shoot, you know, where she instantly says, oh, you know, farmer with Take Back Vermont sign, talking about, you know, these radicals. Oh, you know, this is that kind of person. And she, oh, the sheriff, oh, this, you know, law enforcement person, a white male, you know, this, you put people in these othering shoots. And what keeps surprising her in the book is, you know, that these people are are as complicated and as, you know, interesting and as surprising in some of their responses as she would like to credit the people that she has given those that full acknowledgement of their humanity. Right. So, yeah, I wanted to do that. Yeah.
She, at one point, she observes that it's easier to be able to pin someone down as a type and label them. That's not a quote. I'm not remembering the full quote. But then, you know, I thought that was really smart because I think sometimes when we're doing a thing in fiction, like writing a stereotype or a cliche, to just point it out takes the wind out of its sails and makes it okay. But at the same time, you know, you're also talking about how people are making her, you know, they're putting her in this immigrant or in this Latina box.
Yeah.
There was another thing you did that was similar. She thinks at one point about the couple that she's helping, and she thinks this is telenovela material. In fact, some critics would say too much, ratchet it down a notch, but it isn't a telenovela to the people it happens to. Another way to dismiss their plight, ratchet it down a notch. So that's, again, you're pointing out to us, you know, this could be seen as a bit of a cliche, but it's not. This is people's lives that we're talking about.
Right.
So I just thought that was an interesting way to present it.
Just the ways that we, you know, that we don't grant people their full humanity. And I mean, that is, you know, that is not to see someone. I mean, seeing someone. The next step is, you know, loving someone, you know, but you can't even get there if you don't see people in their full complexity. And it happens within families because, of course, you know, Antonia is from a family of four of them. And each one has had this role, you know. She's sort of the, you know, the sanctimonious person full of, you know, her little wise chestnuts and her quotes. And, you know, there's, you know, Izzy, who's kind of the wild card. And then there's, you know, I mean, there's Tilly, who's, you know, this kind of big, you know, person, sassy, bad-mouthing,
yeah,
kind of wild, loose tongue, cursing, smoking, drinking, you know. But and so they're in these little tight containers of their role in the family. And part of the thing that starts to move in the narrative is how they're each going through experiences that are making those walls. We create border walls in all kinds of ways, and it's making them fall. Right. And that's how real, you know, coming together can happen.
Now, one other thing I was thinking of is that word telenovela. It comes out of another culture, and I wanted to talk about interweaving another language into the prose. You do this mostly, you know, very naturally without italics. You know, you let the text explain itself rather than offering translations. So, for example, so many promesas made and broken. And obviously, you know, we're going to understand that that means promises. Do you want to talk a little bit about interweaving another language in? And when is it a good idea and when is it not?
Well, you know, part of the thing is that it's been an evolving thing for me as well. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I came out of the... you know, classical training, when, you know, if you used a foreign word, you italicized it, you know, you sort of like rang the bell to the reader. And I think that breaks the narrative dream, you know, and I think we don't give our readers credit for how much they can pick up. I mean, when I read certain books by a, let's say, a totally, you know, monolingual English writer, there are a lot of words that sometimes I don't understand or I don't know the full meaning of. And many times I will look it up, but many times I know what they mean. Even though, you know, I was on a quiz show where I had to define it, I really would flounder. So I think we pick up a lot from a narrative, and we have to trust our reader. And part of what you do when you have another tradition, other stories, other kinds of characters, is you have to create that sense of otherness. And how do you do it? Through language. And one of the ways you can do that is by embedding the rhythms of that language when that character is speaking into English, so that he's speaking his Spanish and English. Mm-hmm. Another thing is to bring in words, that will give the reader the sense that they're listening to this as if they were in Spanish as well. And one of the ways you know whether it's working or not is, you know, having another reader. Having for many years, my editor was Shannon Ravenel from North Carolina. And if she got too lost, I knew that I had to work the prose so that she would be able to know, in a sense, and what that word or those words or that expression was within the context of the rest of the prose. So it's just it's just another level of trying to be aware of your reader. And both a reader likes to be learning things and be surprised. They really do like that, but they don't want to be lost. And that's always a fine line, you know. Where are you going to lose him and frustrate him or her? And where are you, that you feel satisfied? I just finished reading a wonderful novel that just came out by a debut novelist. Her first novel in English, the Vietnamese writer. I'm going to get her name so wrong, but the title is very clear: The Mountain Sing. Mm. And Quê Mai, I can't pronounce the rest of her name, and I apologize for that. But it's the history of, it's not a history, it's a novel about the Vietnam War, both pre-Vietnam War and after, told from a woman's point of view, a grandmother and a daughter. And there's so many, a grandmother and the granddaughter, interweaving chapters. And, you know, I read this book and I felt like I was Vietnamese. And this is what happens, you know, you read and you become the other. That's what's so wonderful about reading, you know, that it really is an exercise in compassion, you know, and inclusivity. You take this other in and you feel like you know that world, you smell that world, the details, sensual details put you there, and the language also becomes the way you hear your own English, gets slightly changed and infused with new rhythms and vocabularies because of that novel you read. And, you know, we think of how languages do this more slowly. But, you know, we get words all the time coming into English and staying here and becoming our English words, you know, fiesta, ketchup, you know, these came from other languages. And now they're, we've domesticated them. But this is how, you know, this is how a writer does it with a particular novel or, you know, piece of writing.
Yeah. Well, I think this is related. I think another moment in your book that is really interesting to me is Antonia, at one point, she's talking to Mario, who's an immigrant worker on a farm next door. And at the end of their interaction, just sort of as a tossed off line, she says, anything else you need? And it's just, you know, it's just an expression that, people use all the time. But there is something else he needs, yes. And he's going to ask her for it. And it was just like partially he's that desperate and partially it's cultural. And I just loved that moment.
Yeah, the sometimes things we do in one language kind of figuratively and toss it off. In another language, it might be more literal. Right. You know, I always remember being surprised, and I had to learn that one of the things that, you know, one of the Americans, you know, just kind of an expression of friendliness is, hey, how are you? And you're just supposed to say, I'm fine, how are you? You know, it's just like, hello, thank you. You know, it's just, and they say, how are you? And I thought they really wanted to know. Yeah. And, you know, 10 minutes later, I could see the yawn in their eyes. It was just a friendly, you know, I'm glad, you know, it's just a friendly expression. It didn't mean really something literal. So, you know, it's those little misunderstandings which happen, you know, cross-culturally. And I mean, it happens, you know, within this America.
Sure.
If you go from one region to another, how we understand these expressions and what we mean by them.
Yeah, no, it's also become clear to me recently that our new situation has made me take a look at these things again. Because, you know, when we first got on the phone, you asked how I was, and I said I was fine, because that's what we say. But the fact is that we are in a very new normal right now, and there is a longer story for everyone, right? Everybody could say what they're really going through in this quarantine and in this time. And now, I'm not saying there was anything wrong with either of how we handled that. You're asking the question, my answering that way. But we think about it differently, don't we, now that things have changed?
Yeah, you know, this is the thing I've been really reflecting upon and encouraging the people that I do talk to. You know, we're, instead of going into our default routines, our ways of handling things, you know, there's a wonderful phrase that I read in Rebecca Solnit, that out of the word emergency comes the word emerge.
Mm.
Things have fallen apart. You know, the center cannot hold. But it means that, wow, you know, this is an opportunity to refresh, to hit pause, and to refresh and think about every little thing that we did automatically, including, you know, how we talk to each other. And, you know, I've never been so aware of spring before.
Yeah.
I mean, Phil and I go out to the garden, and I think we might as well take a little ruler and measure how much the stalks of asparagus grew since yesterday when we were out there. I mean, we notice every little nest that any critter is building in the trees around here. My new language is birdsong. I have my tapes, and I go out there and I listen. And I think we're listening to each other and paying attention, because we're aware that we don't know this new landscape. We don't know how it works. We don't know. We can't really make set plans. We can't go back to our old narratives. And so, part of the thing I think for us who are writers is, you know, someone said, oh, now I'm in quarantine, I'm going to get a lot of work done, I'm going to get a lot of writing done. And I thought, go gentle, you know, go gentle with yourself and gentle with the people around you, but gentle with yourself. I mean, maybe this is a time to, you know, to really hit that pause and to really look around and look at, you know, the world, because this is what we're supposed to be doing as writers anyhow, right?
Yeah, right.
But we sometimes just put it in the gated community of our writing life, you know, that when we're actually writing and the rest goes into default. But this stuff is, it's important that this stuff get into our writing. It's important that it does. And so we have to be paying attention to it.
Yeah.
Because when we write the next book we write, we can't let that writing sink below a certain level of awareness of what we've all been through. Otherwise, the books won't really address where we need to, you know, accompany our readers and to, you know, understand experience. This is huge. And, you know, even if you don't directly write about the pandemic, even if it doesn't enter your fiction, the sensibility, the awareness will get into your prose. And that will be important.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great observation. Let's see. I always sort of finish these interviews up by asking for advice for writers. And in your case, I wanted to ask, so your character, Antonia, is often alone with her thoughts. There's a lot going on in the book, but she is often in scene alone with her thoughts. And it, you know, you keep the story absolutely compelling, but I'm wondering if you have any advice for keeping a story compelling while writing an isolated character.
Ah, oh boy. That's such a good question. I don't want to go into automatic pilot with an answer, but I have to think about that. I think, part of the thing is to have the life that she's trying to keep at bay come into her very garage.
Yeah.
You know, into her life via the few people that are still, you know, part of her family through, a crisis with one of the sisters. I think it's the way too that as people that are, I mean, writers are people that are in some ways very much in their heads and solitary and reflective, you know, and we can get, you know, kind of caught up in that, but we also have lives, you know, and people in our lives. And unless we're totally, you know, I guess locked up in ourselves and narcissistic, these people are people that have their lives and their stories. So I think it's that, what that reminds me of, Sheila. I remember grappling with a question and reading my Tolstoy and reading my Virginia Woolf to learn how do they do this? You know, when you have two characters that are having an intense conversation in a party, how do you not just like all of a sudden just those two people are talking for pages. How do you also keep the dinner party going? You know, how do you keep the dancers moving around these two characters and still have that intensity? And, you know, I thought, I went to the writers who did that well to learn how did they do that balance of an intense focus on a little scene and at the same time giving you a sense in the narrative of the larger picture in the room, you know. And part of the way I learn things when you say any advice is that when I run into, I don't know how to do this, because I always say to writers, the best advice is to be a reader.
Yeah.
Because these are your teachers. You go back and you pick up that book of someone who did it really well, and you were so impressed by that, and you reread it as a writer. How are they doing this? You know, how do you have, you know, in this intense conversation, one of them look up and look across the room and describe something they see, only a sentence, and then return to the conversation. So you have that sense of the bigger picture and the intense little scene. So you go back and you read the people who are doing that, have done that so well, so that you learn from them, you know.
Yeah.
And sometimes if I don't remember, I'll ask another writer. I'll ask my editor. I'll say, you know, I don't know. I'm having trouble with this. And many times, you know, another reader friend, another writer, your editor will say, go read thus and such, you know, because I think they handle that really well, you know. And so you learn by reading it as a writer, you know, reading it. It's a different kind of reading than reading it as just sinking yourself in it and getting lost in it. You're reading to look at how the thing was made and put together.
Wonderful. That's wonderful advice. The title of the book is Afterlife, a novel by Julia Alvarez, published by Algonquin. Thank you so much for speaking with me today. It's just such a pleasure.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to be in conversation with you and to be together apart as we're all describing this pandemic time, which, by the way, is what reading has always been, being together apart.
From the Media Factory in the South End of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Julia Alvarez. You can learn more about her work at her website, juliaalvarez.com. This week I have two Write the Book prompts to offer. Both were generously suggested by my guest, Julia Alvarez. First, a prompt she learned about when she was researching titles for her book. She had come up with the idea of the title Afterlife, and so she was researching, as authors will, to be sure her book's title was original and unique. As she looked around on the internet, she found out about another book titled Some, 40 Tales from the Afterlives, written by the neuroscientist David Eagleman. The book offers 40 short, imaginative narratives on the theme of God and the afterlife. Julia says the pieces are sometimes funny, sometimes not, but they are all clever and inspiring. She suggests a writing prompt in which we write such a piece, a 2-to-3-page vignette that imagines what happens when we leave this life. The second prompt that she suggests is to write a 6-word story or bio. Hemingway famously penned this one, For Sale, Baby Shoes, Never Worn. Julia was once asked to contribute to a book titled Not Quite What I Was Planning, 6-word memoirs by writers famous and obscure, which was edited by Smith Magazine. As Julia points out, it can be hard to write a 6-word memoir. If you like, you can narrow it down to what your life is like in this particular year. Either way, here is a 6-word prompt for you from Julia Alvarez. Write your story in 6 words. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. Upcoming interviews on Write the Book include, next week, a conversation with Vermont author Bruce Chalmer, PhD, whose new book is Reigniting the Spark, Why Stable Relationships Lose Intimacy and How to Get It Back. And then the week after, an interview with American mystery and crime writer Jeffrey Deaver. His new Coulter Shaw adventure is The Goodbye Man. As we live through this strange time in our history in which the world is in isolation and various stages of quarantine, I hope that you're able to read and to write. If possible, I hope you're able to support other authors by attending their online events, reading their blogs, following their virtual book tours, and absolutely find your way to their books. For all of you who are trying to write in isolation, be sure to check out the archives of Write the Book, because each episode offers a prompt written out on the podcast site under the recorded interview, or in this week's case, 2 prompts. I'd love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We're also on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and Google Play and all the podcast sites, I think, mostly. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. And if you like the show, please rate it on iTunes, like it on Facebook, and talk about it. I am Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. Write the Book airs every Monday at 4 p.m. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well and have a great week.